with a $5 meal deal with new McValue. You pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal, $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
Hey, Dad, how you doing?
Hello, Kay, doing good. How are you doing?
Doing just fine. Happy Sunday, early on a Sunday, recording before my brunch shift.
That's right. Got to get it in.
It's got to happen. How was your week? You have anything good to drink?
Well, I did have a drink, although I can't say that I enjoyed it a lot. Ooh. After coming up and visiting you, you know, we got the ingredients for the corn and oil drink that we had talked about in the previous episode. And so I got that bottle of Falernum, but what was it? J.D. Thomas, or is that right? J.B. Thomas?
John Taylor.
That's it. Couldn't remember it, but got that bottle and got some Barbados rum to mix it with and tried the corn and oil. It's a little bit too alcoholy for me, so I don't know. It's not my kind of drink. Not saying it's not a good drink, but it's not my kind of drink. But
well, I think a corn and oil is, it's a hard one to get right, and I think that, like, not just putting the lime on as a garnish, but kind of even like going as far as to muddle a few lime wedges in the bottom of the glass, almost go like caipirinha style with it. I think that works a lot better, but. I also just really like Falernum rum and lime in a daiquiri. So I think you should try that. That's a lot more refreshing.
I knew it needed something. That's what I was surprised. The recipe was just 2 ounces of rum and a half ounce of Falernum and a lime wedge on the glass. But that didn't do much in the glass.
No. You got to incorporate the lime somehow, or you've got to go in the opposite direction and try to go like an old fashioned route. And that means you want to cut that Falernum in half and probably bring in a bitter. So I do. Hmm. I think it's a good cocktail, but you got to go in one of two directions. You got to add some acidity, or you've got to add some bitterness, because otherwise you've just got alcohol and sweet.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll try some experimentation, see if I can't come up with something better then.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about you? Did you have any good drinks?
Oh man. I put up a new menu at one of the bars I'm working at right now. We had a little menu change, so I got some original drinks, which I'm excited about. But I think that most of what I've been drinking lately is just trying those and perfecting those. Through a mishap, we got delivered like a ton of vanilla beans that were skewed under the wrong label. So they were just left there. We didn't have to pay for them. So we just had like a couple hundred fresh like vanilla beans in house. And they were going to go bad. So I made a bunch of vanilla vodka. Like, if I look back at my early days making menus where I was like, I just want the weirdest, like, coolest stuff, like, and I'm like, nah, vanilla vodka, that'll sell, let's do that. So that was sort of my, I have vanilla vodka now on the menu, and then from a previous cocktail that I put up, we had passion fruit liqueur in the house. So then I was very excited that as a sidebar to this, I can now make porn star martinis at my bar.
Well, that's a catchy name anyway. That'll get their eye.
We should talk about that at some point. There's not a lot of history there, but it is a fun name. It's a fun drink, and I love the flavors in it. I've been in the lab, so to speak, been doing a lot of drinking, but not for fun, for science.
Well, it sounds like though that most of your menu has been pretty successful that you've added in there. So congratulations.
Yeah, it feels nice. I didn't know how long, you know, pre pandemic in the before days I was writing menus and, you know, going back into the workforce, not sure when I'd end up back in that position was really I don't want to say sad. It was, you know, it's hard to stop doing something you love doing and be like, maybe I'll get to do that again. So it's really nice to get to do that again a little bit.
Well, and ironically, it was like right after we did that episode on how do you plan a menu that you were offered the opportunity to. So it was kind of like, what good timing? You think about all that ahead of time, then bam, it falls in your lap.
Yeah. Well, and it's good that, like, because I wasn't given a whole lot of time just because it was, you know, it's, I think it was sort of like, oh, well, you know what? Someone needs to do this. I think Taylor's the one that's qualified to do this. It's a good thing that my brain is just, I was saying in the tasting that I was happy to have a use for this because my brain is constantly just when I interact with flavors or spirits or whatever, I'm always thinking like, how could I use this in a cocktail? And that's been a useless part of my brain for about 3 years now. Cause I'm like, well, I'm not making menus. So I don't need to have that thought, but it's always firing. So when they're like, do you have some drinks you could put up? I'm like, oh, I absolutely do. I have a backup, honestly, right now. So let's go to.
Well, I'm glad your brain is useful once again.
I know it wasn't for 3 years. That's true. On so many levels. So last week we talked about falernum, which was in your unfortunate cord and oil. I think don't give up yet. I'll give you some specs. We'll make you a better.
All player. Right.
But I thought we could sort of stay on the same vibe this week. Sort of boat drink territory and talk about something that's got some interesting history, some interesting sort of drama around it. We'll get some drama today. And that's the painkiller cocktail.
The painkiller.
Yes. The perfect antidote to a hangover, except for in this case, it will give you a whole new hangover.
Oh, well, that sounds good and possibly ominous.
Have you ever had a painkiller, Dad?
I don't believe so. I don't think I've ever seen one on a menu anywhere.
Yeah. Well, it's similar to a pina colada. It's a mix of coconut cream, orange juice, pineapple juice, dark rum, specifically Pusser's rum, but more on that later. And it's served shaken, although you'll also see them frozen, and usually has grated nutmeg on top.
Sounds pretty good, except I'm not much on pineapple if it tastes pineapple-y.
Well, you like pina coladas, don't you?
I do like pina coladas, but they don't taste pineapple-y.
So that's the pina and the colada.
Oh, okay. Well, then maybe I do like it. I just don't know it.
Well, so it's very much a cousin to the pina colada. The difference is being that it has the addition of orange juice and the nutmeg, and it's usually made with a dark rum. So, you know, pina colada is usually a little bit sweeter, like pineapple, coconut, rum, that's it. Painkiller, a little bit more complex, a little bit more acidity, a little bit zestier. But recipes vary. Usually it's considered a little less sweet than the pina colada, but some recipes are just as sweet, if not more so. So
In the colada family. Well, I do really like coconut, so that's a good offset for me.
That's true. You do. Well, you know, and it's funny for something that, like, obviously the pina colada predates the painkiller by the decades. And it's so close to something that is so well known. It's funny that there is so much, like, back and forth. There's so much around the painkiller when it's really just, it's a riff on a pina colada. But to the history, it's the invention of Daphne Henderson, who was a bartender who was working at a place called the Soggy Dollar Bar in the British Virgin Isles. This was around, like, the 1970s when it was invented. So the bar got its name actually because the island it was located on, Joss Van Dyke, it didn't have a dock on the beach. So people on their boats would just kind of bring their boats up into the shallows and then wade through the water to get to the bar. So
their money would get wet in their pants. So when they came in, they had soggy dollars.
Exactly. When I first started described, I pictured more of like a swim up bar situation. And I was very confused how this was like such a prominent bar. If it was not a swim up bar. I mean, I guess it was sort of a swim up bar, but it was a bar on land. You just couldn't dock and then go to the bar.
Right.
And I think it's worth noting that according to some reports, Henderson didn't actually create the recipe for the painkiller. She sort of inherited it because she took over the bar from its previous owners, George and Marie Myrick. And that perhaps the recipe just sort of came with it. But and it's worth mentioning that they come up sometimes as the possible creators. But Henderson is generally credited for it.
We're going to sell you the bar and our one secret recipe.
I think that's pretty good if a bar comes with a menu.
Yeah.
Because I don't know. I don't think a lot of people do know this, but a lot of times, like, it depends on how the sale happens. But it's not unheard of that when you purchase a location, it was previously a bar. Sometimes you do inherit the back stock. Like, you just get everything that's there. You get the liquor in the basement, you get the whole back bar, and you got to find something to do with it. So sometimes it's nice to start off with a menu.
Well, that's true. I mean, and also if it's a well-established, if it's got a good reputation, you'd want to continue building on that. That's good marketing. Now, if everybody thought it was a lousy bar or a lousy restaurant, then you'd want to change the name and change the offering. So
that is true.
Under new management.
this painkiller, whoever the originator of was, it was a customer favorite. And it caught the attention of one particular customer, that Charles Tobias, who was also the founder of Pusser's Rum and possibly a friend of Daphne's. I don't know how good of a friend he was, but it is possibly why there are records of the original painkiller being made with Curzon rum, entirely different rum. But at some point, she started using Pusser's as the rum in the painkiller, as the go-to rum. Perhaps because they were buddies. So a bit about Mr. Tobias and Pusser's Rum. Unlike a lot of rum brands that have, like, I don't know, a century or so history, Pusser's came about right around the same time as the birth of the painkiller. Tobias was an entrepreneur. He was a businessman before all else. And he had the idea of creating a Navy-style rum. When we're talking like the 1970s, this is around the end of actual Navy rum. But do you know what I mean when I say that?
Yeah, July 31st, 1970, Black Tot Day was the last day that the rum rations were served to the British Navy.
Yep. So before that, you could be a drunken sailor, officially.
Well, that was how they kept your morale up at sea for all that time, is you would get your rum ration, which... It used to be they'd give them a straight pint of it, and it was high proof, and they'd end up with a boatload of drunken sailors in the middle of the ocean, so they had to start cutting it. There's a lot of interesting stories that come out of that with the different things, like where we get the word scuttlebutt and stuff like that.
Yeah, we did an episode on, I think this might have been before your era as co-host. I know we did an episode on Navy rum back in the day, but yeah, it's like... It's funny to me that they just kept trying to, like, reduce it a little bit, but they didn't want to make the sailors angry. So it's like, but you're going to still get the same amount. We're just going to give it to you twice a day, cut in half instead of all at once. Yeah. So instead of getting your soldiers sailors tanked at 10 a.m., they're going to get tipsy at 10 a.m. and continue to be drunk at like 5 p.m.
But that's just wild to me. They did this tradition for 300 years.
Yeah.
Giving out these samples, these rations to the sailors for 300 years. Yeah. That's a lot of rum they gave out.
It's a lot of rum, but it was also, I mean, at a certain point in history, it was pretty life-saving, because before we kind of understood what scurvy was, we started giving them, like, lime juice in with their rum ration. That's where we get, like, grog.
Yeah.
And that... was both a way to slightly dilute it so the sailors weren't getting as drunk, but also to protect them from scurvy because they were getting citrus.
Yeah. Drink your rum, prevent scurvy.
Yeah. But you know, so there's all this really cool history with Navy rum, and there are brands that exist still that were around when the Navy was actually drinking rum in mass quantities, but that is not the backstory to Pusser's Rum. Charles Tobias basically was like, this is a good image. I'm going to go to the British Navy. I'm going to buy, like, quote unquote, buy a recipe from them and get their endorsement on my label in return for royalties to them. So it was more of a image campaign related to the history of Navy rum.
And the Pusser's Rum came from their derivation of the word purser, who the purser was the one that distributed these rations to them, and so that the Navy sailors would call them pussers.
Yeah.
And pussers rum.
Well, and after, you know, he opened up his bottling plant in the British Virgin Isles in 1979, and Pusser's Rum was born. But I say bottling, not distilling, because he was actually just, which is not uncommon in the, really in the liquor world and definitely not in the rum world, he was sourcing all of his rum from Guyana and just blending it at Pusser's. So There are several different bottlings today, but they all share the same general makeup. It's a very like dark molasses flavor, a lot of sweet, a lot of fruit, sort of the house style of Pusser's Rum.
Yeah, when he first approached them, they were not acceptable to that. They didn't want anybody doing it. Then later, when he kept saying, well, we're going to give money to the Sailors Fund, then they finally gave in and decided to do it, but you had to do it the right way. And it's a blend of like five different rums, I think, or something like that.
Yeah, and some like they have more expensive bottlings that are aged. There's no age statement on like the standard, but they're you know, it's based on a dark rum, overproof, so high ABV with a lot of molasses, a lot of sweet. So as you can imagine, again, going back to that, what sets it apart from like a pina colada, using a very rich, sweet, dark rum, whereas usually pina coladas, not always, but often are made with light rums. It's a pretty standout difference. And you know, to get back to the painkiller, Tobias wanted this recipe for himself and for his brand, but originally Daphne resisted. It was her recipe. She was keeping it for herself. So at some point, so the story goes, he snuck a painkiller back to his boat and brought it to his kitchen back in Tortuga and went about trying to recreate her drink. Feeling like he had done so, that he had made a recipe the same, if not superior to hers, he challenged her with her own customers to a taste off. And supposedly he won. His recipe was deemed better than hers. And his prize was the rights to the name Painkiller and the recipe of the Painkiller.
Yeah, I thought it was funny to do his homework to try to figure it out. He had to take order a cocktail, and he had to swim out to his boat and not spill it or get it, get it underwater so he could climb onto the boat with this drink that he smuggled out of there so he could go back and start doing mixings and taste testing it to see what was in there. So I just picture this guy swimming out to his boat with a glass he's holding up above the water, you know.
It all just seems so funny to me too, that it's like, you know, we hear these sort of stories of people trying to like deduce what like a super complex tiki ingredient was, you know, back when we're talking about like, you know, all the Don the Beachcomber, Beach Bum Barrier, all those people that had like 20 ingredient drinks and secret recipes. This is pineapple juice, orange juice, rum, and coconut. it's not the most complex. Supposedly he bested her, he won the rights, although he does consistently include a credit to her on various print materials after that. It's usually always credited to her as the inspiration. I don't know if I think I don't know how good of a friend he was at the end of the day to steal the cocktail from her.
Well, he did give her credit for it, you know, so that's good.
Yeah.
But
I don't know how much
he was he was a really interesting guy, though. I mean, his background, he was born in Canada. He went to school in the United States. He graduated from the University of Southern California with a mechanical and an aeronautical engineering degree.
Yeah.
He was a Marine and a pilot flying in Vietnam. And so he used a lot of that background when he went to the Royal Navy to try to influence him to let him, you know, start manufacturing their rum. And then he started in business in 80 doing that. Got the rights in 79. It was 80 before he got up and running. Then he sold it to Jim Beam for a little while. They owned it for like 9 years, the rights to it. Then he bought it back because he didn't think they were doing it justice because it was getting lost in a big conglomerate. So he bought it back and started you know, making it his flagship, liquor.
Well, and, you know, I think it's looking at how he operated in the liquor world. I think it's definitely the case of more of a, I mean, not somebody that has experience in the world of booze, but definitely somebody that has experience in the world of business. Because in 89, he, after he, you know, won the rights to the name and everything, he trademarked it, which is, that's, we've talked about this before, kind of a no-no in the bar world.
Like, right.
Bartenders understand that drinks are built on a history of drinks. You know, like, we don't, nobody tries to nail down, like, trademark every drink recipe you come up with, because probably somebody's done it before, and probably your recipe is based on somebody else's recipe, which is based on somebody else's recipe. It's just always sort of an open edit forum, the world of drink making. And he did not, I don't think he had that understanding, because he filed that trademark on the Painkiller name and the recipe. And that is something that's really only happened. I think there's maybe like what we talked about, the Dark and Stormy being a trademark, but it's the in apostrophe Stormy. The Painkiller's one. There's something called a hand grenade that's one. There are not many drinks that have this copyright or this trademark situation associated with them, because there's always a trade-off of, like, maybe you own the rights, but you also catch a lot of ire from the bar world.
Well, I mean, could you imagine if every drink name was trademarked, trying to keep up with all that? That would be a disaster.
And I, again, like, it's like the idea of intellectual property is something that I respect, but if you're like the Painkiller, clearly based off of Pina Colada, which came before it, with the addition of one ingredient, like, how, like, that's just, it's such a murky area of, like, how original is your idea if the entire history of drink making is rehashing what's already come before us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In any case, you know, they were known for enforcing their trademark. Like, if bars advertised Painkillers and they weren't using Pusser's rum, they would get cease and desist letters. So that was kind of the deal. Like, you could make Painkillers at your bar. You didn't have to pay us, but you had to buy our rum and use our rum in the Painkiller. And they, you know, they, I think that was something that maybe they could have gotten away with, but they really crossed a line in 2011 when a bar opened here in New York City by the name of Painkiller. So Painkiller opens, it has Painkillers on the menu, and it is not using Pusser's rum in their Painkillers. So Pusser did not stand for this at all. They sent cease and desist. This became a whole possible court case, although they ultimately settled out of court. The end result was really kind of disastrous for both parties. The bar Painkiller had to change its name to PKNY.
Which was kind of like Painkiller New York.
Yeah. And, you know, not nearly, I don't think as nearly as catchy. And they also had to put Pusser's rum in their Painkiller on the menu. But, and you know, that once the sort of news cycle started to pick this up, it was pretty bad for Pusser's rum, because this was not just any bar. I mean, it was opened by two very much like well-respected sort of darlings of the New York City cocktail scene. Giuseppe Gonzalez, who has several like well-known cocktails to his name. Richard Boccata, like, these were not guys that you would want to cross. And so in response to this, overnight, seemingly, all of these, this was 2011, so Facebook was a big thing. All of these Facebook groups popped up of bartenders protesting Pusser's rum, advertising their Painkillers without using Pusser's, making a point of removing it from their menus. Like, it was a PR disaster for the rum brand.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's probably a reflection on that Charles Tobias, that he was a businessman, but he wasn't like big in the cocktail world or anything like that. It was strictly a business move. Cause like when he came out of Vietnam, being a pilot, he had seen that their planes did not have any way to detect being fired upon. So after he left, he developed, because of his engineering background, he developed these computer techniques that would help protect our planes against anti-aircraft fire. And then he sold that in Silicon Valley, and that's where he got all his money to go start this. So he was a businessman and looking at things, what can you buy and build and sell?
Right.
So I think that's what he was doing. And he didn't know the etiquette of working in the cocktail world.
Well, and I think by the time this happened, he was not the head of the company anymore. But I think it still very much carried on under a businessman's ethos, not a bartender's ethos, because the head of the company at the time, when all this was going down, tried to come out and be like, oh, we were just a little mom and pop business, just a little business here trying to save our brand. Don't be mad at us, which maybe would have worked if, I don't know, Walmart was trying to sell your brand. But this was, again, a small business owned by a couple of beloved bartenders. So it did not go well for them. It's not. I think there's a lesson to be learned from this. In fact, there was a class about trademarking and cocktails that happened at Tales of the Cocktails a couple years ago. And they talked about this case specifically. And it was like, this is a lesson that whatever you think you're going to earn by trademarking your cocktail, you're probably going to lose by the anger that you're going to incite in a bar community that understands that the way we make good drinks is by keeping it like an open format, you know, like,
right. Yeah.
If I if a cocktail that I made, if I walked into another bar and saw that same cocktail name and ingredients on a menu, I would not think that was an instance of somebody stealing from me. I would think that was an instance of your drink is maybe catching on. Like, that's, you know, we're talking about the paper plane. Everybody knows that Sam Ross made the paper plane. If he went around and tried to get money from every bar that put his drink on the menu, that would be disastrous.
People would quit selling it.
Well, and his legacy exists because there are so many people profiting off of that idea. He's making no money off of it, but that's part of his legacy. And I think roundabout he makes money off of it because he's beloved for what he offered up to all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of like that old saying, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery.
Yeah. And also I think it makes people ask the question a Negroni has Campari in it. No, a lot of other red bitters you could probably sub in there and get something that will approximate a Negroni. But because the consensus is a Campari makes the best Negroni, people will look at you funny if you pull any other bottle. If they order a Negroni and you grab any other bottle, they're gonna be like, what are you doing? That's not a Negroni. It has to have Campari. So if you have the spirit that suits the drink best, you don't have to trademark it. And I think that when you do, it's like, oh, so you need to force us to use your rum in a painkiller because given the option, there are better rums to use in this. Kind of has that, you don't just win this based on palate, you win by force, which is not good.
Or even if it's just breaks even, any other rum, the drink tastes the same. So, then what makes yours so special? Why should we buy yours?
Yeah. But, other brands have done this, but I don't think that there's been an example of such an egregious public offense as in the case of Pusser's and the Painkiller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I like the story about where the word scuttlebutt came from, that it was the container that their watered down rum would be put in, and they'd all stand in line with their scuttlebutts waiting to get them filled up. And they would be exchanging rumors while they were in line waiting to get it filled up. So that's where the term scuttlebutt came from, for rumors and gossip.
Oh, I didn't know that's what that meant.
Yeah, that's what they called the containers, was the scuttlebutt. But that also became synonymous with rumors, because while they're standing in line, that's what they told.
Oh, that's interesting. I've never heard that before. Well, yeah, I mean, the history of I think it was a smart decision to capitalize on all of the imagery and the history around Navy Rum. Clearly a smart businessman, less of a savvy, navigator of the bar world.
Right. Yeah. It makes you wonder what motivated him to do that in the first place. Cause it wasn't like there were other people fighting to go get this Navy, brand of rum that they used, even though they did it for 300 years.
Yeah.
Nobody was fighting to go get it. And then his labeling that he put on the bottle is everything that's also official Navy insignias and stuff.
Yeah. Well, and he paid for that. I mean, that's
right.
Part of the royalties go there.
They said 50% of the profits from the rum that they sell goes to that retired sailors fund or whatever they call it there.
I mean, that's, you know, that's cool. And I, like, it's not, I have been behind bars that have Busser's rum. It's tasty rum. I think it's unfortunate that now I perhaps work at not one, but two bars that have either things they brazenly call the painkiller or just very clear painkillers that we've called something else, that I think that the distaste for Busser's has continued, generation of bartenders, which is unfortunate because it's not a bad rum. But you know, that's the gambit you make when you try to own areas of intellectual property that have been shared as a religion of bartenders for decades, if not centuries.
And even though they don't blend it there or make it there, their headquarters is in Tortola, which is, we have been there before on one of those cruises that we went on. That was one of the stops was Tortola, but I didn't know that at the time. But that's where their headquarters is, which was the old pirate hangout, which was the inspiration for all the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. Tortuga.
I think I said Tortuga earlier. Yeah.
Yeah, it's Tortola is the real island that the pirates supposedly hung out at, and of course they call it in the movie Tortuga.
Yeah. Well, there you go. There's the history of the painkiller and the bartender drama around Busser's rum. Still a perfectly delicious rum. You know, if you're a fan, that's fine. You can be a fan.
I have never seen that anywhere. Just looking at the bottles, I don't think I recognize those from somewhere, but I may have to try some at some point.
Yeah. Well, not too long ago, I think maybe a year or two ago, there was a pop-up of PKNY. I think it was here in Brooklyn. They did a what am I trying to say? Brought all the same. One of the owners came back. Some of the old bartenders did a pop up at another bar, sort of in remembrance of it, because it was a very beloved bar. It was short lived, but you know, who knows? They're still out there. Maybe we'll see it again.
All right. Well, the painkiller. Keep that on your list of things to try.
Yeah, but don't try it too publicly, or you might get a knock at the door. All right. Well. Thank you, everybody, for being with us. Thank you, Dad, for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me. I love looking at historical thing and learning, you know, trivial facts and, you know, finding out things like that and scuttlebutt and all that other kind of stuff. That's just interesting to me.
That was your favorite part of this, wasn't it? Scuttlebutt.
Well, that was one of it. But the whole thing, you know, and the guy himself, you know, the whole thing was pretty fascinating to me.
A lot of characters. Thank you all for listening. If you want to find us on socials, we are Neat Boozecast on Instagram, meettheboozecast@gmail.com. If you want to email us your questions, your comments, big shout out to our Patreon. If you want to join that and support our show, they are the reason that this show gets made. So thank you all. And if you want to talk about your favorite painkiller to use, you can do that
at Meet the Boozecast group page on Facebook.
Okay, I do that.
All right. We'll kill your pain.
Thank you very much. I've been Taylor Squirrel.
I've been Tommy Squirrel.
And this has been
me. Yeah, it's a wonder with the way I like pina coladas that no one's ever made me one of these before. I've never even seen anything like it. Well, maybe that's why.
Well, I don't know. I went out because when you were at my spot, the frozen that you tried is basically it's a painkiller with a different name.
That's really?
Feel free to be.
Well, I like that. Yeah, I like that.
I didn't realize it till I was doing it. It's like, because I just keep calling it close to a pina colada with orange juice. I'm like, oh wait, that's literally a painkiller.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, what do you know? Maybe I've had one and somebody slipped me a Mickey.
Yeah, well.